Hi, everyone. I'm Brian Kiley.
I'm Judah Sanders.
And this is Engaging Culture, a podcast presented by Bridgeway Christian Church. On this episode, we will look at why do we think everything is so awful if it's really not. We'll talk about the idea that we cannot lie our way to the truth, and we'll talk about how we can have better political conversations. We'll have a little bit of fun along the way. All of that and more on this episode of Engaging Culture. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Engaging Culture Podcast. Brian Kiley with you, along with Judah Sanders.
Good morning.
Good morning, Judah. Recording here on a Monday morning.
Or evening.
Whether you're doing the dishes, going to bed, going for a walk, going for a drive, we appreciate you listening, and we're going to jump right in. Pastor Judah, best thing you saw this week?
Yeah, we got to have our young adult annual camping retreat. Anybody who knows me knows I hate camping. Mm-hmm. However, there's something really, really special about getting away with people that you care about and getting to spend some time with them and with the Lord, and it was just a really sweet and special time, with the exception of the bear that held me hostage in the back of my truck for probably a good hour because I was so afraid to get out in the pitch black dark at 1 a.m. in the morning when I realized there was a bear. The funny thing is, there was a big dog, or at least we thought it was a big dog, that came out and chased it away, and I could not see the dog. I just heard the dog, and I heard the bear run away, and then come to find out it was a tiny chihuahua that thought he was running the block. So shout out to the good chihuahua up in Nevada City for saving my life.
What was the best thing? Don't mess with chihuahuas, man. 100%, they're vicious.
100%. Best thing you saw this week.
So not as deep. Most of my ministry work was behind the scenes this week. But anyone who knows me knows I love basketball. Mm. And my goodness, what an incredible Olympics this has been in so many regards. I commented to my family, I'm a little sad that it's over. And here's what you have to understand. So a couple things. Number one, I love the game of basketball. I hate lazy basketball. Mm. I hate poor effort. I mean, any kid I've ever coached knows they can make all the mistakes they want, and that's fine. We'll coach them up, whatever. Never going to get, you know, upset due to, you know, a mistake or a missed shot or a turnover, whatever. Like, that's all fine. It's part of the game. But if you are going to go out there and give poor effort, I have a seat right next to you, and we'll put someone in who actually wants to play hard. And that's sort of my philosophy and kind of all of life. And my son and I are watching the semifinal basketball game, the third quarter, and I'm on the elliptical, he's sitting on the couch, and we are like yelling at the TV at just lazy, terrible basketball being played by the best players in the world in the United States. They're down by 17 to Serbia, and this game just looks like it is over, and it was so bad. And then the switch flipped in the fourth quarter.
Come on.
And they just went off. And I watched it, and I'm still not quite sure how they won that game. But it was an incredible comeback. And then in the championship game, Steph Curry, who I'm not the biggest Steph Curry fan because he's the best player for my least favorite team. Mm-hmm. But obviously respect the talent. And he was just unbelievable in the final 3 minutes, made 4 3-point shots so that Team USA won by 11, the last of which was just absurd. How he did it, I don't know.
But
loved it. It was the best of times and the worst of times for Team USA basketball, but it ended as the best, and it was sure a lot of fun to watch. It made me excited for the upcoming season.
I'm enjoying my imagined picture of you and Matthew in the living room, like yelling at the TV. It feels like a very funny picture to
and
me.
I have so ingrained effort into Matthew that, like, I always say, like, if you put a step counter on, like, all the kids on the court when we play, like, he would by far take the most steps. But he also knows, like, he knows that that's how you play the game. And we were not having it as guys are standing around watching their teammates shoot threes and then getting confused by really basic, you know, screen and cuts on offense, which I know is a great passion of yours, Judah, but we will move on and talk about something else.
I can be present.
We will be right back. We are back, and there was a column in the Wall Street Journal on Sunday that caught my attention, and the headline was, "The world isn't actually going to hell in a handbasket. Human beings have been complaining about moral decline since, well, forever." And Pastor Judah, I want to read the beginning of the article, and then talk about a little bit about kind of the argument that the author is making. She writes this. She says, "A lot about the world feels dark right now. We're reeling from a turbulent presidential race, processing an attempted assassination, divided by protests, and a barrage of images on social media that feeds our anxieties. Sometimes it seems as though we're living in the worst of times. The truth is, we're really not. I realize that might seem hard to believe, and indeed, a robust study shows that most people think that society is declining morally, steadily becoming ruder, greedier, and less kind. Yet the study also concludes that people are just as good as they've ever been." And this is fascinating to me because you've got, on the one hand, I think we all tend to, not we all, many of us tend to complain, like, oh my gosh, the world is so terrible, everything's awful, look at all this evidence of sort of corruption and greed and just moral decay and all of that all around us. But you come to realize, like, people have been saying that forever. I mean, 100%. She cites, you know, Jeremiah in the Old Testament, forever. Cicero in ancient Rome, Machiavelli in the Renaissance, Cotton Mather in Puritan New England. Like, this idea of, like, oh my gosh, the world is so terrible is a very common thing that 100%. We hear. And not just that it's terrible, but that it's getting worse.
Yeah.
And you see this in secular spaces, but I feel like we see it even more in the Christian world. I mean, literally since, I mean, I became a Christian when I was 15, which would be 1997. And I just feel like a consistent theme I have seen ever since then is this idea that, oh my gosh, these days, everything's so
bad.
Gosh, we need to, you know, be this and that, especially in these times. And even, you know, one of my favorite podcasts, their sort of tagline is how to live as a Christian in confusing times. And on some level, I'm like, every time is confusing to a degree, but also
100%.
This continued focus on things are bad, things are bad, things are bad. It's constant.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is?
Yeah, you know, I think there's a couple of things. The author in the article talks about this idea of negativity bias and that we're particularly susceptible to that, and that, you know, over time, our brains kind of learn to pay more attention to bad events or bad news, bad emotions, and that it's a way that our brains kind of learn to detect threats, right? Yeah. But I think the other thing that happens, right, is that sometimes I think what people are trying to communicate is that things are different than they used to be.
Interesting.
And I think that difference, and I think for all of us, is just always an adjustment. Some of us handle it worse or better than others. But I think that that's sometimes what people are trying to communicate, that things aren't the same way that they were, that I was used to, that I was familiar with. And I think that sometimes having to adjust to the change, I mean, I was just thinking about, you know, things, you know, we're trying to learn, you know, new technologies, right?
Yeah.
That in itself is not a negative thing. And we would all argue, I'm really glad that I have my phone and it can do what it can do, and my computer that can do what it can do. But I wonder if there's this kind of amalgamation of always having to learn something new, always having to adjust, whether we're talking about cell phones or pronouns. And I wonder if that can contribute to these negative feelings.
Yeah.
But I'm curious, like, are there legitimately ways that you feel like things are worse than they used to be? And then how are you distinguishing, like, is it actually bad, or is it just kind of a perception of badness?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of both. On the one hand, yes, we live in a fallen world. Certainly that is kind of fundamental to a Christian worldview, that we recognize that the world is broken, that the world is broken by sin, and that sin has effects that are far-reaching.
Mm.
Additionally, obviously there are terrible things happening in the world all of the time. Everything from social injustice to war to famine to corruption. I mean, you name it. There's also, I mean, deviance of every sort and kind. Like, that is not a controversial statement. I do think that there are a few factors that lead to us sort of obsessing over that in a manner that might not be healthy. And one of which is cited in the article that I'll get to in a second. But number one, we have access to so much information.
Yeah, that's true.
Right?
That's true.
I think I used this analogy in a sermon once, that the 100 Years' War that was fought between France and England, did people that were living in South America at the time even know it was going on?
Right, get daily updates and tweets about it.
Probably not. Whereas I can open up Apple News and see everything going on in the world wrong all at once. So, and that's not to downplay the legitimate awful things that are happening in the world, but it's to say, I'm not sure things are worse globally. In fact, by most objective metrics, things are better on planet Earth than they've ever been in terms of human flourishing. But there is just so much awareness that you just know. Like, this just popped into my head. So that's probably not a great anecdote. But imagine your neighborhood.
Okay.
If all of a sudden, like, and I know a few of my neighbors and most of them I don't. Imagine if all of a sudden you knew everyone's business.
Yeah, everything going on in everybody's
all
house.
Of the problems that they were dealing with.
That is a terrible idea.
Right? And you'd be going, oh my gosh, this neighborhood is going to hell. Pardon my language. Yeah. Right? And
yeah, that's a really good analogy, actually.
That level of awareness is not helpful.
But then you're right. I agree. The thing that I'm wondering about though is like, if I heard that, maybe what I would be tempted to do is say, I don't want to listen to the news. I don't want to be online and almost want to pull away and kind of hermit out because, you know, I don't want to hear all that bad news and be negatively affected. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts about that? What would you say to that?
I think there have to be limits.
Yeah.
There have to be limits. There are topics that I block on Apple News because I'm like, this is just stressing me out needlessly. It's not a situation and it's not typically about bad news. Usually, filter out. Like, I've had enough politics. I want to hear what's going on in the world, but I don't need to hear any more about President Trump or Vice President Kamala Harris for a little while. Like, I just don't. Things like that, where I just go, this is not helping me. And I think we have to go, okay, is the news that I'm getting serving any positive purpose? Is it inspiring me to action? Is it inspiring me to prayer?
Is it helpful?
Is it helpful in some way?
Yeah, that's right.
If it's just doom and gloom, I mean, they call it doom scrolling for a reason, right? Where we're just getting constant bad news, constant inflammatory, you know, information or opinions or whatever. And it's really not serving any positive purpose.
And not just bad news in terms of bad information, but I think that there's also something to the way punditry kind of works right now, where often you'll turn on the news and it'll be four people sitting on the panel.
Yeah.
And they're all saying that everything is bad. They're
right.
All saying, they're not just reporting, hey, a bad thing happened, an earthquake happened in Haiti, but they're also, you know, just kind of lamenting that everything is bad.
Yeah.
And one thing that the author mentions in the article that I think is helpful is she challenges us to fact check our assumptions.
Yeah.
Right? And I'm wondering how you are kind of doing that in your own life. Like, how are you, one, how do we identify if I'm making an assumption? Is this an assumption or is it a fact? And then how do I fact check it?
That's a big question. We could probably do a whole episode on that topic. Mm. But, there are so many elements to that. I think, number one, you have to know yourself and know your own biases. That is so, so important. And you have to understand that psychologically, we come sort of programmed with confirmation bias, that we tend to accept and believe things that support our the beliefs we already have. So two sort of principles in my own life is, number one, I want to argue against my own beliefs. And honestly, like, I'm not that interested in debating somebody, in debating someone. I don't do a lot of debating in general, but if I'm going to debate somebody about an issue, I don't really want to debate someone who's not able to argue against their own views. Because if you can't argue against your own views, you probably don't understand them
that's
well.
Right.
And it's really going to be difficult for you to be fair-minded about the topic.
That's right.
Number two is I want to actually develop a reverse confirmation bias, where I am skeptical of things that support my beliefs, so that way I'm digging into them. And then also there's just the broader, and this is where we don't have time to get into this now, is just having a healthy media diet, understanding the difference between, say, the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, which are both very reputable news sources, one a little more liberal and one being a little more conservative, and say like the Huffington Post and Newsmax, which are like extreme in those two directions. And recognizing like, okay, some, you know, pundit with a microphone whose whole job is to rile people up, like, that's not worth my time. I'm probably not getting good information.
100%.
So, and to recognize, I think to your point, you talked about the panel thing, negativity sells. And folks got bills to pay. And they pay their bills because we watch. And for whatever reason, and I don't really have this, so I'm not I don't really understand it that much, but we are just so drawn to negativity and hot takes and they're bad, which actually leads me to my second point that I was going to bring up for why we focus on the negative. I'm curious to get your thoughts on this, that we get a level of comfort by locating problems in the world outside of ourselves.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
That if I can go, they're the bad guys. If I can go, oh, things are awful there. What that does is it allows me to not look within myself, to deal with my own sin, to deal with my own brokenness. And I always say Christians of all people should feel safest looking within and should have the least need to try to locate brokenness out
into the
world.
Something about a speck and a log, so,
you know,
I think the text says.
A smart guy said that once, and to go, okay. And that's where I, even as I look at my own life, to go, okay, I don't want to obsess over problems I see out in the world.
Yeah, that's right.
You and I were doing a thing last Tuesday night, a men's ministry event, and I shared the idea of people say, love the sinner, hate the sin, and I heard someone else say, love the sinner and hate your own sin.
Mm.
So to be able to go, I want to locate problems within myself as opposed to, oh my gosh, the world is terrible. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that there are a few things that can help us with this kind of negativity bias or this idea that everything's going to hell in a handbasket. One, as believers, we're actually supposed to be optimistic.
Mm-hmm.
So even if it's hard, that we need to think about that almost as a spiritual formation practice, as a spiritual discipline, that I am supposed to be hope, and my hope is built, I think the song says, on nothing less.
Yep.
So I think that that's a really important kind of place to start. I think in terms of the media diet, I think, you know, we really do have some tools to filter that, right?
Yeah.
Whether it's All Sides, you know, the website that helps you kind of learn things like, you know, who's funding the information that you're reading, who writes it, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And also media literacy guides like fair.org, which are just helpful in just determining what you're reading.
Yeah.
But I think that there's also something to, and the author talks about this in the author, leaning into positive gossip, right?
I like that. Yeah, I like that idea.
I love that. And so she talks about, she says, talk more about positive things with people, right? Look for things positive to say. And I think one of the things that I think I would like to start practicing is, even if I'm having a heavier, harder conversation, to make sure that before I exit that conversation, that we talk about something positive.
Yeah.
And that might feel, at least when I initially start, a little hokey,
yeah,
a little corny.
Yeah.
But I actually think that, like, that is revealing in me how I actually prefer sometimes to talk about negative things.
Yeah.
Totally. And then the other thing she says is, she says, take a leap of faith on someone. So in an effort to kind of see the best in other people and hope for the best and believe the best,
mm-hmm.
She says, ask somebody for help, give somebody more responsibility, right?
Yeah.
And so how can I do that? How can I ask for help, even if I don't necessarily, quote unquote, need more help, but to invite more help so that I can see the best in people?
Yeah.
And I think, yeah, just a reminder that no problem that we're facing today is a new problem.
Yeah.
It shows up in a new way, but we've always had wars.
Yeah.
We've always had political conflict. We've always had issues with our neighbors. We've always dealt with biases.
Yep.
And from the biblical days to now. And I think that as Christians, we have the most reason to have hope and the expectation of good things.
And I think I can imagine someone listening to this conversation and going, oh, so we should just ignore the bad in the world, or we...
Is that what you heard? Go back, rewind it a little bit. Listen again.
Or that we as Christ followers ought not to stand against evil in our world.
Or engage.
And that's obviously not what we're saying.
Yeah.
But to be able to go, okay, how do I engage with the world and the brokenness in the world as a Christian?
Yeah.
Meaning, I am doing so from a hopeful space, not a cynical space.
Yeah.
I'm doing so from a space where my goal is to see people transformed as opposed to see people crushed and destroyed and defeated and, you know, called names and whatever. And to be able to say, we're not actually arguing against agendas, because when we do that, it's easy to kind of disembody people, like, oh, well, they're just all part of this group. But I actually am trying to help serve and support and help people. And where there is darkness in the world, I want to be, first of all, examining the darkness in my own heart, and secondarily, doing what I can to help bring light into the darkness where hope and healing and transformation can occur. And I think as Christians, it's important that we keep that mindset, especially in a world where, my goodness, how much language is there about, you know, we need to destroy these people, they're this, they're that, and that obviously is not a Christian perspective.
100%.
We'll be right back. We are back, and Next thing we're going to look at is an article from Christianity Today by a guy who I quote all the time named Russell Moore. And he wrote a piece called "You Cannot Lie Your Way to the Truth." He said, "Falsehoods are easy to tell in politics and they can even creep into the church, but nothing takes us farther from the capital T, truth himself." And Pastor Judah, Russell starts out the article by talking about the new vice presidential nominee, Tim Walz, and of course, Kamala Harris, who's at the head of the ticket. And he said how initially people took to social media after Walz was chosen to contrast him to J.D. Vance. And as he writes in the article, plenty of contrasts were fair game, that of a former high school coach versus a Yale venture capitalist, for instance. Some people framed the contrast this way, though: Walz is a normal guy, while Vance is a weirdo who, and I'm going to adjust slightly to filter in case there are children in the room, who enjoys the company of couches. The next paragraph. "The past several years have required sentences I never imagined I would have to write. Here's another. J.D. Vance does not enjoy the company of couches. I believe the proposition I wrote to be true, and my opinion of the politics or personality of the Republican vice president nominee has nothing whatsoever to do with that belief." Now, that he is, of course, is right about that. For those who have not heard, this is a sort of meme thing that is going around about the Republican vice presidential nominee, and it's false. It's just simply not true, and that is it. It is a joke. I would regard it as a off-color joke and all of that. But it is false.
That's putting it lightly.
That's putting it lightly and an extremely off-color joke, right? And you know, there are innumerable examples of this sort of conduct from, you know, President Trump and all of that. So I'm not trying to harp on this particular instance, but I think it's an important example of kind of this idea that the argument that Moore is making is that essentially, we can't just make stuff up in the name of defending our side or kind of believing that what we're doing is okay because of the righteousness of our cause. And he cites some other examples of things that sort of never happened in politics. Like, for example, Sarah Palin never actually said, "I can see Russia from my house," but Tina Fey did on Saturday Night Live. Barack Obama obviously never advocated for death panels for grandma. But he says, "That's what happens in politics, especially in a social media era. After all, most people don't really believe the Vance couch memes. It just helps with morale." And then here's the next thing, and this is where I want to get your take here. "The problem for those who belong to Christ, though, is when the fallenness of the fallen world starts to feel normal."
Yeah, that's right.
"The problem is when you start to think your lies can serve the truth as long as the vibes feel right and the outcome is what you want." Pastor Judah, there is probably no other arena where I have seen professing Christians comfortable with embracing lies, furthering lies, telling lies, looking the other way at lies, than in the realm of politics. And I find this deeply distressing because honesty is a core Christian virtue. The devil's first language is lying, so saith Jesus. What are we to make of this? Why are we, and I don't mean any one person in particular. Why are we so comfortable with lying in pursuit of what we believe to be a cause worth fighting for?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it has a lot to do with confirmation bias, right? That I think that sometimes we just refuse to ask the question, is it true? I think that particularly Christians, particularly the church, I think I'm seeing less of people saying, "Oh, that's a lie and I'm fine with it," and more of, "I heard a piece of information," right? Like the J.D. Vance couch thing. People who are not his biggest fans were not open to ask the question, is this true? We just said, hey, maybe some folks think he looks kind of creepy, and they said, well, he looks kind of creepy, and I'm just going to assume that this is true, instead of saying, well, is it true?
Yeah.
And I actually think that's more dangerous, because at least if you're embracing a lie and you know it's a lie, then you know that you're wrong, right? You know that that's wrong. But I think the bigger danger is that we are so looking to be affirmed in ideas that we already have, that we swim in dishonesty all the time on accident. And here's the thing. I think that, you know, us embracing lies and liars and people who have shown themselves to be dishonest, I think that that is dangerous because it is so antithetical to who Jesus is. Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. And I think the other thing is that we cannot use the excuse that I hear a lot that, well, they lie in politics all the time. It just comes with the territory to make us comfortable with it, right? Like, that's what happens. It's like, well, you know, all politicians lie, so I'm just going to choose which set of lies and which liar I'm comfortable. It's like, no, actually, I want to operate in the truth and function in the truth. And so I think that that's what we've got to do.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts about when we find something that is not true or that is not all the way true, that maybe we have believed or shared or thought, what is our next step once we kind of figure out, oh, that wasn't true as Christians?
Number one, here's part of the thing that really gets in the way of being honest is there is a reflexive defensiveness for political candidates, political parties, whatever, 100%. Where we just feel this need to defend them at all costs.
Mind you, these people don't even know your name.
That is a moral emergency. So we have to pay attention to our own hearts to go, as I am encountering falsehood, is my quick first reaction to defend? If that is happening, that is highly problematic. And I would encourage anyone who finds themselves doing that to do whatever work you have to do to not do that. Because if you're just going to reflexive defensiveness all the time, you will inevitably end up endorsing and embracing falsehoods and untruths. So that's number one. I think we have to examine sort of our own character and our own heart and our own formation. Because if we're formed in the way of Jesus,
come on,
we're not going to do that. If we're formed in the image of the Republican or Democratic Party, or we're formed in the image of I am all in on Donald Trump, or I'm all in on Kamala Harris, and they can do no wrong.
Them people don't know you.
That is, sorry, I don't mean to be so like heavy-handed in my criticism here, but like that is just unimaginable to me. I just cannot imagine. Like, that is so antithetical to what it means to be a Christian. So I think the idea to go, okay, I actually am not okay with lying.
And just like as a thing.
That's like a really basic thing.
Just as a thing. Yeah, that's
and,
good.
And I look at, and here's why. And I think Russell Moore, which by the way, there's this like, it is so, it is, I laugh so that I don't cry. There is this like, you know, populist, nationalist sort of, you know, social media wing of kind of professing Christians who, you know, embrace Christian nationalism and all of that. And I would point listeners to session 3, part one of our Faith and Politics series to hear my 25-minute critique of Christian nationalism. But they're like that. They're that way. And Russell Moore is not that. Russell Moore is a classical conservative, always has been. And like these like populist folks refer to Russell Moore as like a leftist, which is like the dumbest thing I've possibly ever heard in my life. He is not a leftist in any regard. Anyway,
I just want you to know I want to tease you about that reflective defensiveness for somebody you respect.
Well, here's the thing.
I'm just giving you a hard time.
I know you are. But I'm glad you brought that up because I want to clarify. If it's reflective defensiveness for a lot, like you're defending a lie, that's one thing. Russell Moore is being lied about and to go, no. But anyway, whatever. It is what it is. We're going to move on. He says in the article, Jesus is not the one telling us the truth. He is the truth, as John 14:6 says. To distort the truth into a half-truth or a quarter-truth, to advance a lie, is a personal assault not just on the person you're lying about or the issue you claim to support, but on Jesus Christ himself. The problem, then, is not just is not just what that does to whoever you're lying about. The problem is what the lying does to you. Outside the gates of the kingdom, John tells us, are, quote, everyone who loves and practices falsehoods, Revelation 22:15. The grace of God is amazing and can redeem into truth those who lie, but it doesn't do so by leaving liars to their lies. Those who would tell us that evil can be overcome by evil are not just lying to you, but they're lying to themselves. And he cites Romans 12 and John 1. He goes on. In a politically idolatrous age, simply refusing to lie about one's opponents will be viewed as an act of betrayal. Which, I don't know about you, Pastor Judah, if that is betrayal, sign me up as a betrayer. Because I'm just not willing to do it. It's just not worth...
It's also, here's the thing, it's also just this is just from a purely practical, secular standpoint, it's not necessary. Like the like whoever you don't like politically is human enough that there are just things you can just be critical of that are true. You can just say, hey, this policy or this idea or this thing that you said, I didn't like, and I want to talk about that. We actually don't need to work so hard to make up things about people that we don't like. Because they do a good job being human. Like, relax.
Okay, why are we talking about J.D. Vance and couchers? There are plenty of things.
Plenty of things.
Homeboy called Trump America's Hitler.
And now,
there's plenty of things you can get.
And the same with Kamala Harris.
And exactly.
We don't have to question her blackness. We can look at policies.
Yeah, why are we talking about, I mean, President Trump came out the other day accusing her of doctoring photos of her crowd sizes. Like, why are we talking about that? Like, hit her on any number of issues. Like, it's just, it is, I think that's a great point. It is so... silly and unnecessary. But I want to continue one more thing. Sorry, I've read a lot of the article, but it's good. He says, that idea of it's an act of betrayal, it will make you vulnerable to suspicion that you're not really, quote, one of us, whoever us is defined to be. Lying, then, is easy. It fits with the pattern of the world, and it will protect you from the mob. Sometimes the pressure is even stronger when the church takes a welcoming and affirming posture toward liars as long as they lie about
the right people. Yeah, that's right.
And man, I just remember hearing someone say years ago that we live in an age where anything is acceptable as long as it offends the right people.
Yeah.
And I think on some level, and to our point from the previous segment, I don't think this is necessarily new, but we are totally down with lies about the bad guys. Yeah. And that is antithetical to a Christian worldview.
Yeah, yeah. So I think ultimately we have a responsibility to tell the truth, and not just tell the truth, but to repeat the truth.
Yep.
And so that just means that we got to do our due diligence to filter and to have a little bit of a critical lens. That doesn't mean a negative lens, but a critical lens on all information that comes before us, and to ask this question: is this true? How do I know? And then is it worth and healthy to repeat? And if we don't know some of those answers, then I think sometimes just we don't need to repeat it. We don't need to say it.
We don't. That's true. And we need to sort of clarify in our own minds too that calling out someone's lies or recognizing that something that someone said is false is actually not an act of disloyalty. And you can go, okay, this is my candidate, this is my person, you can go, this 100%. Is my pastor, 100%. This is somebody I support, I'm in close relationship with, and who I want the best for, and go, you lied here, and that is not okay.
Yeah.
Like, those two things can exist in the same
way. Right.
And I think there's real danger if we're not able to do that, because then all of a sudden, you know, we just end up endorsing lies and untruth all over the place, which obviously is not healthy.
And the last thing I'll say is that this is not something that's easy, and this is something that, you know, I certainly struggle with. I mean, you know, how easily, again, and I don't think that there's a ton of people at Bridgeway who just enjoy lying on folks, but I think that there are a lot of us who can easily buy into lies, myself included. So I don't want to sound like, you know, the fussy pastor who's telling you to be a better person. I just think that all of us can just be a little more intentional and a little more prayerful, right?
Yeah.
Lord, help me to discern, right? There's a reason that Christians have the Holy Spirit, and there's a reason that we ask for wisdom and discernment, and it's to help us navigate all of these things.
Yep. Amen. We'll link to the article in the show notes. Check it out. It was a good one. We'll be right back.
So we've been talking a lot about all kinds of things revolving how we think about and communicate about issues in the world, particularly politics. And we talk a lot about politics on here. We want to think about how do we have better political conversations, right? Like, we don't just want to wag our fingers at ourselves and say we're not doing a good job, but how can we do a better job having political conversations? Pastor Brian, what is something that you find necessary to having healthier, better political conversations.
Yeah, so we're gonna each share three. And my first one is, it is important that we build trust first.
Yeah, that's good.
And one of the real problems with locating politics as close to the center of our lives as many of us do is we end up talking about politics in environments where it really isn't appropriate or helpful. Some of us, we talk about politics online where people can learn our political opinions before meeting us, yeah, which is highly problematic. Others of us bring politics into conversations with folks we hardly know. I remember I had this experience recently. I was playing pickleball, and most people that you meet playing pickleball are delightful. And this individual I'm about to talk about may be a delightful person in many other regards. But
it doesn't sound like it from the buildup.
Literally, we were 90 seconds into a, hey, how are you? Nice to meet you. What do you do? This and that. Where this person made what I would regard as a pretty inflammatory political statement. Mm. And whether I agreed with the statement or not is irrelevant, that I was just stunned. I was so taken aback by, I hardly know this person's name. And she's making we would talk that way to strangers is totally unhelpful. Yeah. Like, I just don't know what possible good is going to come from that. And I think, so what we need to be able to do is go, if I'm going to talk about politics with somebody, there has to be trust in the relationship.
That's right.
That there has to be, we have to have the ability to know that we can disagree on this topic and we're going to be okay. It's part of why I think, you know, politics around the Thanksgiving table or politics when you get together with maybe people you don't see that often. Mm-hmm. It's just the trust isn't there. It's not worth it. And I think that oftentimes we have to be careful, and this kind of falls in line with the idea of building trust, is just kind of do a cost-benefit analysis of conversation.
Like, that's right.
Like, let's say, I know you don't like when I say your presidential vote doesn't matter in the state of California, but I'm sorry.
Because it does. Get out there and vote.
I mean, get out there and vote, but like,
for whoever.
California is not a swing state. So let's just
get out there and vote.
Let's just, yeah, absolutely. Get out there and vote. I'm pro voting. I plan to vote myself. Don't get me wrong. But if, say, a family member and I, who happen to be on opposite sides of, say, the presidential race, we'll just use the biggest example. Let's say we get into a conversation about it, or I want to provoke them to discussion about it. What is the possible benefit there? Okay, maybe they are persuaded, which is unlikely.
Yeah.
But what is the possible detriment? Now, we've become frustrated with each other. There's possible harm in the relationship because we just don't have the level of trust to be able to talk about these things. So I think we have to be careful that we only have these conversations where there's mutual trust, where our relationships are sturdy enough to handle disagreement, and where there's willingness to listen. So how about you? What's your
question? Yeah, I think one of my first steps is, I think, define the goal of the conversation, which is kind of what you were getting to a little bit, I think, even in some of what you were saying. And I think to define the goal of the conversation on purpose, as opposed to kind of falling into a conversation, but actually deciding, what do I want the outcome of this conversation to be?
That's good.
And I think that a lot of the time, what we need to hold ourselves accountable to is making that goal to be getting understanding, right?
Yeah.
More than even being understood. And we've talked about that in some other ways on this podcast. And I think it's really helpful to define the goal to the person you're having the conversation to.
Yeah.
So when, you know, uncle brings up so-and-so at the Thanksgiving table, before you jump in and say, well, uncle, I think that, hey, uncle, I'm happy to have this conversation with you because I really want to understand you and I hope you really want to understand me. It's really hard to be mad at somebody who says that to you.
Yeah,
no matter what they just said they believe or who they're voting for, it's really hard to, if somebody says, I want to understand you. No, So I think define the goal of the conversation.
Well, and I think that so often we think the goal is obvious when it's not, right? Like, oh, I don't need to say. We all know what we're trying to do here. And I just don't think we are, so much research has shown we are much worse at reading other people's minds than we think we are, right? So my second is somewhat related also to my first, and this is a little silly, is talk about other things. I truly believe one of the best ways to have better political conversations is to have less of them.
Yeah.
Most conversations accomplish almost nothing, and they leave people stressed out and angry. And I think we just need to be okay with being around people who think differently than us and just simply talking about other things.
Yeah.
And not in some weird avoidant way, but in just a manner that goes, yeah, we, you know, whatever. We don't need to I come from a very politically diverse family, and I just spent a lot of time with extended family recently. And it's just like, yeah, we don't need to talk about this stuff. Like, let's just talk about other stuff. And we can enjoy each other's company, talk about our family, our work, you know, our hobbies. And I think that we locate politics so close to the center of our lives, frankly, often putting in a place where Jesus is meant to live, that it really causes us to bring up politics in inappropriate settings. So I think we just need to learn to go, okay, number one, we build trust. Number two, it's okay. You do not have to bring politics into everything you do, and just talk about other things, enjoy the company of the people that you're with.
And what that means, just to add on to that, what that means is that you're going to have to consume more than just politics, right?
Totally.
That can't be the only thing, the only podcast you're listening to. I'm holding myself accountable to this. The only YouTube videos you're watching, the only articles that you're reading. It cannot just be that, because that's then you don't have anything else to talk about. What else is going on? Go outside. Play.
And this is a little bit of a stretch on what the text actually means, but you know, what does Jesus say? Out of the overflow of the heart, the mouth speaks. And our hearts are formed so much by what we consume. So I think you're absolutely right. It's a huge reason why, I mean, I'm not interested in it anyway, but I don't watch debate shows. I don't watch these panels where people are, you know, squares on the TV shouting at each other. Like, it forms me in very negative ways. I really limit the amount of political news I consume, that I want to give the precious minutes and moments of my life to things that are going to edify me and help me grow in godliness, which people yelling at each other on TV has yet to do that.
Shocking.
For me. I don't know about you.
Shocking.
But no, I think you're right.
I also think this is my next thing, that when we're talking to people about their political views, remembering that people make their political decisions from deeply personal places. And so we need to define others in terms that they accept and really as they define themselves, right? Yeah. And so, you know, if I can think about sometimes, you know, people say, oh, those, you know, lib, you know, there's some really rough language about progressives or about conservatives.
Sure.
And I think that we actually need to avoid that, not just in front of them and with them, but even behind closed doors.
Yeah.
How do you see yourself? And what that leads to, and I'll just go ahead and sneak this one in, is asking really good questions about how do you see yourself in this?
Yeah.
How do you see this opinion? What language would you use? And actually, what I'm learning, and then just have to remind myself of, is that, like, when you get behind the idea, what you actually find is that the reason they're at that idea is very similar to the reason you're at your idea,
yep.
Right? We talked about this once when we were doing the gun episode, and we talked about how the people who want guns want them because they want safety in general, and the people who don't want guns don't want them because they feel like there's a lack of safety.
Yeah.
So at the root is still safety.
Yeah.
And that provides some opportunity, I think, for understanding.
And what I love about that is that it's, let's find common ground. What are we actually trying? What are the goals that we agree on? And we might disagree on how to get there, but I think to be able to know, okay, we actually are trying to get to the same result. We're just coming at it in different ways. And that at least helps us realize, like, you're not trying to destroy the world and neither am I. We actually want the same things. How do we get there?
Yeah, so 100%.
My last thing is we have to value relationships over issues.
100%.
We are Christians. We are called to be salt and light in the world. And if we convince people who we love that they're wrong about an issue, but we damage our relationships in the process, that is a loss. And winning an argument is not worth losing a friend. Part of having good, hard conversations is being self-aware enough to know when you're at the risk of saying something stupid,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
We have to know when our emotions rise to that level, it's time to say, you know what? I care about you. I value our relationship. I value our relationship more than I value my opinion on this issue. So let's just talk about something else.
That's right.
And I think our standard cannot be, because I just hear this so many times, it's a cliche. Oh, well, those people do it. Those people do it. Those people do it. And we do that to justify our own behavior when that's not our standard, right? And I think it's very odd that we look to people that maybe we don't respect or disagree with and try to justify our behavior by appealing to them. Our standard is Jesus.
And, 100%.
You know, in talking about all of these topics, I've made mistakes in all of these areas, and I imagine you have as well.
Never have.
Yeah, and I'm not perfect at it. But it's honestly, it's a huge reason why, even though, like, we use this show to try to give people a framework on a lot of different issues, but just right now we're in a political season. We try to use this show to give people a framework for healthy Christian political engagement. Like, personally, I don't like talking about politics, even with my friends. I just don't really want to. I'd rather talk about other things.
And see, I'm the opposite. I very much enjoy talking about politics. I just think that we have to be careful.
Yeah, we got to be careful. We got to make sure that we're doing so in a way that keeps the main thing, and that's Jesus, and that we're demonstrating his love, even in the midst of disagreement.
That's right. That's right.
We'll be right back.
So we're going to close today by doing something that we may end up regretting inevitably. We're going to play, we're not going to play a game. We're going to try to end the segment with a little bit of encouragement. Pastor Brian and I, we're going to try to give a mini sermonette of encouragement. However, the way we're going to do it is we are going to alternate coming up with sentences in this mini sermonette, and each sentence has to begin with the next letter in the alphabet. So I will start my sentence with the letter A, and then Pastor Brian will have to come up with a sentence with the letter B that somewhat makes sense in this mini sermon that we're writing.
And I cannot emphasize this strongly enough.
It was like a terrible idea.
This has not been rehearsed.
At all.
We are flying blinder than blind right here.
This might be chaotic.
All right. Pastor Judah.
I'm starting?
Yeah, we're starting. You're starting. Come on now.
All right. Always remember that Jesus gives you what you need.
And being prayerful is a helpful way to connect with him and remember his love for us.
Contrary to what we often think about what he does in our lives.
Doing good works is also a way to remind ourselves and remember that we are the hands and feet of Jesus.
Even when we feel absolutely useless.
And failure is inevitable, but even when we're not living up to our highest standards or doing all the good we would want, we can remember the grace of God and that he loves us no matter what.
So give yourself the opportunity to pray this week to the Lord about these things.
And when, see, you just used so, and I just said and.
You said and like three times. Keep going. I was gonna call you out off air, but yeah.
All right, we're back. Having the mind of Christ is possible when we pray and when we connect with him, and that will help us in so many different areas of our lives.
If we can also invite other believers to journey alongside with us, this work can be a little bit easier. This is the easiest one, Pastor. Jay, really?
Jesus.
Very good.
The answer is Jesus. Jesus invites us to cast our burdens upon him. Jesus invites us to share our hearts with him. And Jesus invites us to ask him for guidance. And we can count on the fact that when we pray, he listens and will respond.
Keep him at the center this whole week. As you're navigating some of the other things that we talked about in other subjects, that ultimately Jesus is the one who's going to help you do these things.
And living in this way, God did it again. Living in this way keeps the fruit of the Spirit central in our lives and allows us to show that fruit to the people around us.
Make time for prayer, for solitude, for silence, for devotion, and for rest so that you can be your healthiest person as you're navigating it.
Naming your own spiritual needs, the need for those things, can be very helpful in making sure we're staying spiritually healthy, spiritually filled up, so that we can exude that joy of the Lord.
Often this requires some scheduling, some planning ahead. We can't just slip, trip, and fall into a healthy spiritual rhythm, but we actually have to be intentional about it.
Putting those things in your calendar may be necessary. You got the letter Q.
Quieting our minds and our spirits and our souls is really, really critical to walking this out.
Radical dependence on Jesus and on his Spirit to help us is not only something we need, it is something that that God freely offers us. And we have the opportunity as we connect with him to make those things central in our own lives.
Scripture is also really important to that connecting. So make your time to really get into your word and not just to read it as something to check off your list, but really to like eat, to feed your soul, to take care of the soil of your heart.
To live with those things at the center is The Best Way to Live and has been so transformative for me and I know for so many others.
Understand that all things are possible through Christ.
Voluminous.
Oh, that's good.
Writing has been done on this topic, and maybe the use of a devotional book or a book on spiritual formation might be helpful in this process.
Wherever you are and whatever you're walking through, remember that you really do have access to the Holy Spirit.
Xylophones are not often used in worship bands, and this is a non sequitur.
Yet, if you find xylophones helpful in your worship practice, use them. Close it out, Pastor.
Oh, gosh. Oh, goodness. Zoo animals are not what we are, but rather we have minds that can, even to a small degree, comprehend the love of God, comprehend the gift of community, comprehend the presence of the Holy Spirit in our lives, and live in response to these things. And that is good news.
Amen.
You know, I don't think we said anything like overtly heretical there, but that was painful.
That was not our best preaching. Oh, but listen, goodness. Like we always say on this podcast, have the hard conversations, do the hard work. It makes us better for it. And we'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening. Leave us a quick rating or review if you like what you heard. We'll see you next time.